all of us. Everyone at the State's Academic Medical Center. All working together to deliver complete care now and for generations to come. All over the state, including hospital and clinic locations from the Delta to the Gulf Coast. All for one reason. You, the University of Mississippi Medical Center. All for your health.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast.
On Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit, you get information about foods you should eat to stay in good health and tips on how to stay active. I'm Josie Bidwell, host of Southern Remedy Healthy and Fit, and Associate Professor of Preventive Medicine at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Listen to the show every Monday at 11 or subscribe to the podcast by searching for Southern Remedy with your preferred podcasting app.
Good morning. This is Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio. This is Dr. Jimmy Stewart, Professor of Internal Medicine and Pediatrics at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. It might be one of those mornings, everybody, so I might get a little tongue-tied today. I don't know if I had too much coffee or not enough coffee. We'll see. But I am delighted that you are tuned in this morning listening to us. This is the program where you can call in with any type of medical question that you have. You know, a lot of our Southern Remedy programs are excellent on other days of the week, but they tend to be more thematic, and this one is wide open for you to sort of drive the content. So we depend on you to pose your question. We'll try to answer those questions if we can on the spot, or if we can't, we'll try to point you in the right direction. But we would love to hear from you right now. Maybe it's a new symptom that you have. Maybe it's a new medication, or maybe just something you don't understand about the medical problems that you have. Certainly, we are here to help you get that information that you need to be a healthier you. If you're not able to call us today, we would also love to hear from you by email. You can email us by sending those to remedy@mpbonline.org. And if you're unable, I know in the middle of the day, little work schedules get in the way sometimes of listening. If you're unable to listen to us live, you can always check us out online, either through whatever podcasting app that you have. Just look for Southern Remedy on MPB Think Radio, and you can download that and listen to us at your leisure, and toss us an email if you have any questions based on that content. Boy, a little chilly this morning. Well, I hope everybody stayed safe with a lot of the storms coming through. You know, it's that November weather. I talk to people in other parts of the country, and they're like, tornadoes in November? You've got to be kidding me. That's right. Welcome to Mississippi. That's those of you who have lived here as long as I have know that's just part of it in living here. But we do have to be careful. And thankfully, I think for a lot of people in the state, it wasn't quite as bad as we thought. No, there were a lot of cancellations and things. I actually had clinic yesterday morning and had a couple of cancellations in patients and not knowing what the weather would be. But thankfully, I think for most of us, we were able to skirt by that. But it does, you know, that's part of your health is remaining healthy and preparing for different things. And certainly, you want to not blow off a lot of those warnings that come your way. If you have a tornado watch or bad weather coming in, you know, sometimes we can't predict what's going to happen, but certainly it's much better to be prepared than it is to go through that and have a lot of damage to your home or to your vehicle or your life. And that's the most important thing. So we want to make sure that everybody stays safe out there and in doing whatever you're doing day to day. So some of my patients have been asking me about, you know, different kind of vaccinations, the best way to protect yourself against different things. One of the more common, you know, vaccinations this time of year is flu vaccine. We have been seeing some flu, both type A and type B. Quite a bit. We usually see an uptick in the week or two after Thanksgiving. That just makes sense. Everybody sort of comes together. We've got people traveling from all kinds of different places and transmitting lots of bad things to the people that they're around. But there's another one that particularly if you're older that patients ask me about a lot. And, you know, the flu vaccine is recommended once a year for pretty much everybody to try to decrease the prevalence of flu in the general population. But especially if you're at risk, and that tends for flu to be young and old or immunocompromised from whatever reason. So if your immune system is down for whatever reason, that puts you at risk for having complications of the flu. But even then, even if you have the flu and you're out for a couple of days, that's a couple of days of missed work or school. So that's a big, can be a big impact both economically and on your education, and just causes a lot of disruptions that we could potentially avoid. But another vaccine that I'm often asked about is the pneumonia shot or the pneumonia vaccine. So this is a pneumococcal vaccine. There's a couple of different times that we give this. One is in childhood. So there's a couple of immunizations during childhood of pneumococcal. And this is against one of the strains of Streptococcus. So it's not the strep that you get, you know, in the back of your throat like strep pharyngitis. But it is in that same family. And the biggest thing that this causes is one of the more common causes of things like pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia in particular. And again, if you're older, if you're immunocompromised, if you have lung disease, then it may be a reason to get the vaccine. I didn't cough on purpose, I promise, to try to get everybody to attention on that. But this is the pneumococcal vaccine has changed over time. There have been several different derivations of it. So just like there are different types of dogs, but they're in the same species, but like different breeds of dogs, you can think about bacteria sometimes in the same kind of fashion. So we have different types of Streptococcus pneumoniae. So because there's different types of that, these vaccines have been developed, and a lot of them have immunizations against that multiple types within the same shot. So in other words, you get one shot, but it may cover 15 or 20 different types. So we've had different ones throughout the years that are developed, and those have been developed to be each one a little bit better than the one before, basically. So they study these after they give them. They look at the population. They look at were you vaccinated for a certain type of pneumococcal bacteria, and did you get pneumonia after that? And the latest one that's out there, you know, most of the time we've been recommending for these general population, once you get to age 65, then you get one dose and that's it. For a while there, it was two doses. There was a 13 and a 20, 25. Well, now we have a pneumococcal vaccine that's a 20 valent. Okay, so that's the 20 is all you have to really understand about that. And it does cover a lot of the newer strains of pneumonia and tends to have a little bit better immunity in the trial. So if you have not been vaccinated, you're over the age of 65, ask your doctor about this or ask your pharmacist at a local pharmacy. You don't have to wait till you go to the doctor to get it. And if you do qualify age-wise, then that's something that we would recommend, again, to try to decrease how much risk you have of getting pneumonia from these types of bacteria. And somebody may say, well, you know, even if I get pneumonia, can I be treated with an antibiotic? You can be, you know, with proper diagnosis and treatment. However, even the ones that are treated, if you're over the age of 65, it does put you at risk for a hospitalization. It puts you at risk for more what we call comorbidities, or things that can bad things that can happen because you have an illness. So just keep that in mind and ask your physician if you should have that. And you know, some of my patients are like, do you have to get it every year? No. Once you get that, you're pretty much good to go until they change those vaccines again, until they come up with something better. I'm waiting for, you know, we probably never will have that one vaccine that covers like multiple things. Certainly we do have combination vaccines, particularly in childhood, that can do that. And they're have been proven to increase immunity to those different pathogens, whether they be a virus or a bacteria. But there's really not, you know, just one-stop shop where you just get one of those. But they are effective. They're safe. They do help decrease the risk of different things. And if you have lung disease, you may want to talk to your doctor, even if you're not 65. So that is asthma, COPD, or emphysema. All of those are conditions that put you at risk should you get pneumonia from whatever cause, whether that's flu or whether that's a bacterial cause. So talk to your physician about that. Give them a call. If they say, hey, we're super busy right now, I really don't want you coming into the office, just say, hey, can I get it at my pharmacy? So that's a great way, sort of an adjunct to get it. You don't have to go to the doctor to get those. You can get those at the pharmacy even without an order. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning live, and would love to hear your questions that you might have about any kind of medical issue that's bothering you or somebody else in your family, maybe even a friend. You can reach us this morning with those questions. Send an email to remedy@mpbonline.org. Lots of stuff in the news about different things. I thought this was an interesting one. There was a study that was looking at highly processed foods, so things like hot dogs, pizzas, potato chips, all the good stuff, right? Highly processed foods, as it turns out when you study them, they meet the definition for addiction. So that's very interesting, and sometimes as addictive as tobacco. So if you think about that, and as addictive as tobacco is, you know, I tell my patients who are smoking, who are struggling with that and trying to quit smoking, we certainly have a lot of good, effective ways of doing that, whether they're medical or non-medical. You know, quitting smoking is really difficult, and it's because of the way that it interacts with the brain. Well, it turns out a lot of highly processed foods meet those same type of definitions for being addictive. So it's very interesting in the way that they affect the brain. They increase dopamine levels. Dopamine makes us feel good. And when it's withdrawn from the body, whatever that substance is, whether that's a food or a drug or medication that is causing an increase in those dopamine levels, then that can feel sort of a letdown. So it sort of feels like a depression, and you want more of those things that sort of stimulated that dopamine response. So it turns out you get these spikes from highly processed foods and you want more of them. That explains it, right? You're sitting on the couch and you're like, I really want a potato chip. Actually, nobody says that. They said, I want the whole bag of potato chips, because your brain has been conditioned over time to want that substance and it gets habituated to it. So it's like, I know that I can get that and feel a certain way. And it's also why we say we have comfort foods, right? So those are things that we eat and we feel better. So there's a lot to, we already sort of knew that, and a lot of people have been saying that for decades. But this is just some interesting research that they looked at a number of people and look at the dopamine levels amongst other things, and basically a scoring system to say how you felt after eating. And the good news is you can rehabituate the brain, so it's not like just there forever. You can train the brain to to not be as addicted to these substances. Of course, it's easy to slip back into that. So knowing that is probably pretty powerful for a lot of patients. A lot of people say, you know, well, I know if I eat a lot of that, I'm probably just not going to stop. And that's usually what I tell my patients too. Look, if it's something that you know that you're going to crave, don't let it in your house. I mean, don't put it in your pantry or put it on your cabinet or in a drawer somewhere. If it's going to cause those cravings, then just don't get it in there, because that is so easy to get that. So just some interesting research there. We're going to go to Sandy in Gulfport. Good morning, Sandy.
Hi. Question. I was found to have an enlarged thyroid gland. They did a biopsy, and it was inconclusive. They sent it away. It was inconclusive. They repeated the ultrasound the following year. They did another one. It was negative, and it's still large. Lab results have always been normal, but over the last several years, the skin has dried out excessively to the point that it's developed eczema. The hair is now falling out. And I have acquired a new onset of atrial fib. So what now?
Yeah, so that's, the thyroid gland is an interesting endocrine gland. So its function is to sort of control the metabolism of the entire body. So, you know, Sandy, that's one of the things that we look for if something's abnormal is the functioning of it and how it relates to different symptoms that people might have. And you gave some of those symptoms, so that's... It doesn't always go along with a malfunctioning thyroid gland, but sometimes it's, it is. So you mentioned dry skin, your hair can thin, people might gain some weight on it. They might lose some of the hair in their eyebrows, particularly on the lateral third. So all these things can be symptoms of an under-functioning thyroid gland. And every once in a while, you can have changes in the size or structure of the gland. So the thyroid sits, which you know, but a lot of our listeners may not, on the front part of your neck. It looks like a little butterfly. And sometimes that can become enlarged for different reasons. Sometimes it's the tissue itself in the thyroid that gets bigger. But it might be in relationship to, by itself without any kind of stimulation. But it also might be that the thyroid gland itself is not getting enough iodine, which tends to not be a problem in most developed countries because we use a lot of salt, and salt has iodinized salt has iodine in it. And there's a lot of iodine in other foods. In some parts of the world, there's still some what we call a goiter from an iodine deficiency. So that goiter is just an enlargement of that thyroid. So you mentioned several other tests, and it sounds like they've really thoroughly tried to figure this out. They've done an ultrasound. An ultrasound is to look for abnormalities in specific parts of the thyroid because sometimes it can be just one part that's growing and you can have a little thyroid nodule. They may follow that up with a biopsy, which sounds like they have biopsied it to look for specifically any causes that are making that thyroid gland enlarged. Sometimes there can be antibody production against the thyroid itself, which can cause it to be enlarged. The frustrating thing about diagnosing these, though, for patients and for physicians is that it takes time. And sometimes it's not even just days or weeks. Sometimes it's months. And you have to monitor several different things. So it sounds like they've checked off some things that are happening that could be happening right now, like cancer, like an overactive thyroid, by stimulation of something or an autoimmune process. But that doesn't mean that they're just catching it early enough that it's not manifest itself in those ways yet. Now, Sandy, one thing I didn't hear you say, maybe you did because it was a little bit staticky there. Did they do some tests to see if your thyroid was overproducing or underproducing? That's like a TSH or a T4?
Yes. All thyroid labs have been totally normal the entire time.
Gotcha. And are you seeing your regular doctor for that, or did they send you to an endocrinologist?
I see an endocrinologist also, because somewhere along the line I developed diabetes too.
Gotcha. Yeah, and anytime you have one, endocrine abnormality, sometimes they sort of travel in groups too. So I'm glad you're seeing an endocrinologist. An endocrinologist is just a specialist in problems with the glands of the body and the hormones of the body. So that's good that you're seeing them. I don't have a definitive answer for you, Sandy. And even, if those tests are normal, then it may not be causing those other problems like the dry skin, the changes in your hair. But it's probably going to need to be monitored over time. And every 3 to 6 months, probably they're going to probably want to recheck some of those hormone levels or even follow up with an ultrasound of the thyroid gland. Some of my patients have had similar things where their thyroid gland was just enlarged. All their tests were normal. And we're just sort of monitoring things. Cosmetically or even, medically, sometimes the thyroid can get so big that it can press on structures where it can cause a little bit of problems. And in extreme cases, sometimes, surgical removal of the thyroid is required, or either debulking of it. But that's usually a really rare thing that you have to do these days. But the biggest thing would be monitoring those things. Now, we talked a lot about underfunctioning thyroid gland. AFib is not typically caused by a thyroid gland that's not producing enough hormones. It's an overproduction. And it sounds like if those levels are normal, that's probably not what was causing the AFib. It may be something else that's causing the atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation is just an abnormality in the heart rhythm itself. So I would say this is one of those cases where they're just going to have to follow it over time, and the endocrinologist would be the person that I would lean on the most with this, and just to see them probably every 3 to 6 months until either things get better, they stay the same, or they're going to get, you're going to get a diagnosis at some point because those hormone levels are going to change.
Okay, thank you for your time.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for calling. Yeah, thyroid difficulties and problems can be extremely frustrating, even when you diagnose them. And those of you who have hypothyroidism know this. You can be diagnosed with hypothyroidism where you're not producing enough of that thyroid hormone. It's an easy thing to treat in that it's a pill that you take once a day that has a synthetic hormone that replaces that function in your body. But sometimes you chase those numbers and you end up having, you don't feel better initially. It can take up to 2 to 3 months to start to feel better, and sometimes up to a year. So that's something I always warn my patients about. Hey, even when we have a diagnosis and we treat it, this is one of those things that takes a long time to get better. And even then, there may be a lot of dosage changes with that hormone. Some of you may have heard us talk about the most common formulation of that is called Synthroid, and it's one of those real tricky medications where you need to take it separated in time from other medications. So usually I tell patients the first thing in the morning, take it. Don't eat anything with it. Don't take your vitamins, like particularly things like calcium, and don't take any other medication until 30 minutes after taking it. So it's one of those that it's a little bit tricky, and you can have some changes in how it's absorbed in your body if you take it with other medications. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning, answering your questions, not just about thyroid, but about anything that you might have. And we're going to talk about a couple of more things, including emails. That email address, if you want to email us, is remedy@mpbonline.org. We're going to go to, I believe it's Rao from Vicksburg.
Yes.
All right. What's your question this morning?
Hello, Dr. Jimmy. I have a quick question related to what you were just saying about thyroid.
Sure.
I have low thyroid, and I have been under treatment, taking levothyroxine 50 mcg once a day. And I have been told by my pharmacist and my doctor that I should take it first thing in the morning, at least half an hour before I have my breakfast. Okay, and I have been following that routine for several years now. I have a question for you. I would prefer, because I'm used to getting my coffee first thing in the morning, and I had to wait half an hour. So I would prefer, to take the pill at night time before I sleep. And I've been told, I think by somebody, that they contacted their endocrinologist, and they told them that it's okay to take the pill at night time, the last thing before you go to sleep. And the only other medications I take in the evening are I take an amlodipine 5 mg, for, BP control, and melatonin just before sleep, just to get me into sleeping. So my question is, my BP is under control, my amyloid, my levothyroxine, the thyroid levels, TSH and all, they're all well within the range. So is it possible for me to switch from morning to evening just before, late at night before I sleep in terms of the thyroid pill?
Yeah, I think that's fine. Now, you still would need to separate when you take the thyroid, the levothyroxine, from the other medications that you're taking at night. So the amlodipine for your blood pressure and the melatonin for sleep, I would still say that needs to be 30 minutes difference from when you take those. But yeah, it's fine. And I tell you know, I'm fine. I know a lot of physicians would say, I'm glad you're endocrinologist that they said that, but because really, if you're consistent about it and don't take other things around the time that you take it, it's going to be fine. They can adjust the levels if there's just a little bit of difference. But the levothyroxine is a very long acting medication.
Yes.
So,
yes.
You know, it's not like you're going to feel that much different or it's going to work that much different. But I just tell people, hey, just stick with it. Take it at the same time. But I do have some patients that have told me the same things. Like, it's just too hard for me to take it that way in the morning. But I think I can do it in the at night. And that works for them. Their levels are fine. Keep in mind that every time you change a timing or a dose of levothyroxine, it's probably a good idea to recheck levels 2 months, anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks after you make those changes. So that's, you know, if you do them before that, and I know that's a doctor decision, but you know, just keep that in mind, because a lot of patients will be like, well, why aren't we going to recheck levels till 2 months later? Because that's the amount of time it takes to get sort of readjusted to those kinds of things. Not so much with just changing it from morning to night, but if there's a dosage change, that's usually the case.
Yeah. My question is this, following up that, I started out with 50 mcg levothyroxine, and then my doctor felt it would be better to increase it to 75, and I've been following 75 mcg for several months. He tested it, and I'm going to have my lab test again sometime in the middle of December, you know. And you know, my BP has been fine. It's well within the normal range, you know, the 120, 30 range, and, you know, 70, 80 range.
Right.
I'm about 83, you know. So, my thyroid has been fine. My only question is, I usually take amlodipine immediately after I take my supper, which is about before 7. And if I take levothyroxine, it would be about, you know, 9 or 9:30 or something like that. And then, you know, my melatonin would be like, you know, 20 minutes before. But I can adjust that. You see, my problem is, with the levothyroxine in the morning, sometimes I have to go out of town or catch a flight out of Jackson or, you know, something else. I have to do a doctor's appointment somewhere, you know. So those kind of times I can't, you know, either I have to shift everything or wake up early or something like that, you know, which I don't like to do, you know.
Right.
So my other question is, I think I may have asked this of the pharmacist, if something like that happens, and, you know, I have, for example, if I was taking it in the morning, let's say, and I'm not able to take it at the regular time, but I have my breakfast, but I can take it, say, after 2 hours or something like that, after taking my breakfast and any other medication, but leave half an hour or 1 hour before I do anything else. Is that okay in terms of
differing? Yeah, that's fine. And one time like that is not going to be a big change in it. And a lot of people ask me, well, what if I forget a dose one day? I would, you know, what I tell them is take two pills the next day, because again, that's not going to be, it's not like you're going to be hyper that day. It's going to even out overall. And, there are some situations where I know endocrinologists have given the whole week's worth in one day. I wouldn't recommend that for everybody. It's much better to take it at the same time in the same way every day for consistency. But, if you miss a dose, this is one of those that you can just, now I wouldn't say that with all medication, but thyroid, the way it works, you can, you know, just take an extra one the next day. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, doctor.
Thank you for calling.
Always, you know, I enjoy talking with you and your responsiveness to patients.
Oh, thank absolutely.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to go to Carl, who I believe is in Rocky Springs. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
All right. What's your question this morning?
Okay, first of all, the medication you and that person was just talking about, was that Synthroid?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the levothyroxine is the generic name for Synthroid. Yeah.
Okay, I just want to find out from my wife. She takes that.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you heard of they sell this at a vape shop. It's called HHC. It's a vape.
Uh-huh.
It takes the place. Supposedly it's legal. I don't know. You know, I just heard about it the other day.
So it's in the same family. It is a little bit different than THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana.
Right.
But HHC is... it's a little bit different, but it is one that causes some of the same types of things, the euphoria that you have, you know, all the things that you can sort of get high on, it can do the same thing. The other question people ask about HHC is, will it show up on drug tests? The answer is, it can. So I'd be a little careful with that. So you can be impaired with it. It's not as, you know, CBD is the other thing that patients ask me about. And while CBD is unlikely, if it doesn't have significant levels of THC in with it, it's unlikely to, you know, cause some of the same symptoms of euphoria and that high that you get from THC. It can still test positive on drug screens too. So, HHC, I'd be sort of careful with that because I wasn't aware if it's, you know, legal to sell like that.
It's in the vape shops now.
Gotcha. There's no real evidence that it's any safer than THC either. So I'd be a little bit careful about that.
Right. Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Pat in Gulfport. Good morning, Pat.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I have a question about rheumatic fever and what you can tell me about it, because I have this mystery that I'm trying to solve in my own life as to whether or not I had it as a child.
Yeah. So it's rheumatic fever is a side effect, or it's a complication of an untreated or inadequately treated streptococcal infection. So if you had strep throat, or sometimes if you've had strep from a skin infection, then this can be sort of an autoimmune response to this. And rheumatic fever was one of those. And the reason they call it rheumatic is some of the symptoms can be related to like joint aches and pains, usually with a fever. The long-term complications, you can have some damage to the heart valves of the heart, and this used to be one of the leading causes of damage to heart valves. So depending on what happened on that streptococcal, you know, that infection, then you may have had some complications. And you can't just have a high fever, though, because that's really common. If, you know, particularly as a child comes in with strep throat, or even, you know, strep from whatever source, they can have a high fever with that. It's another constellation of symptoms with it.
Well, I, as a baby, I did contract the strep. My mother told me, and this was late 50s, early 60s. And then as a very small child, I would present with the very high fevers, and she would rush me to the emergency room. And that's back when they dump you in the ice water.
Yeah.
And she said they did that. And then as I grew up, I would have these excruciating joint pains, and the doctors would say, oh, that's growing pains. And then I had a heart murmur. I was diagnosed with a heart murmur. And so I've just been, you know, thinking back on all of this. And when I talk to my regular doctor about it, they just kind of look at me like, okay. So I'm just trying to take it serious whether or not I should see a rheumatologist about it. I had some heart problems, but I had the heart cath and they didn't see anything. But, I was just wondering, because I know it's kind of rare.
And the joints typically are at that first, it would have been the first time when you had the fever. So that shouldn't be something that's relapsing because of that. So I don't think that's related to it. Now, you could have had, you know, if you did have rheumatic fever, and certainly the fever is another thing that doesn't come back either. It's not like after you have it once that you have the same symptoms. It's the damage to the heart valves is the biggest thing. I think if you're that would be the thing that I would hone in on. If you had a little leaky valve, it, you know, dependent, that's common too, and you can have that without any kind of other cause. It doesn't really change how they deal with it right now, but, you know, as long as they're following that, the most common way is with an echocardiogram, where they put that little jelly on your chest and they're looking at the actual, you know, valve and area and everything. But, that would be the biggest thing that I would say that you needed to follow up on. But the other symptoms, less likely to be rheumatic fever. And there's not really this far out. it's not like you would need, you know, a special treatment for that. It's just to be aware of the complications.
Okay. All right. I understand. That sounds good. Thank you so much.
Yes, ma'am, and thank you for calling. This is Southern Remedy. Dr. Jimmy with you this morning. We've got lots of good calls going on right now. We've got three more on the line that have been patiently waiting. We're going to go to Sue from Beaumont first. Good morning, Sue.
Good morning. I'd like to ask you a question about gallbladder.
Sure.
I think gallbladder trouble runs in our family. Everybody I know has had their gallbladder out, but every time I eat something cruciferous, I know I'm going to have trouble, but is there any kind of medication a person could take to dissolve a gallstone? And for that matter of fact, why isn't there some kind of medication a person can take to dissolve kidney stones?
Oh, good. That would be great, wouldn't it, for both of those things? Yeah, so, you know, gallbladder dysfunction can take on a couple of different things. One is that you just have a lot of stones in there. So the gallbladder's function is to consolidate, is to concentrate bile. So bile is produced by your liver, and it is concentrated in the gallbladder, and then it is pumped into the small intestine to help break down foods, particularly fatty foods. And you can produce more bile and have more gallstones sometimes from different things. So increased estrogen production. So if you have a lot of pregnancies, obesity can be a risk factor. Certainly family history, as you mentioned, can be a big risk factor, or sometimes medications. But as far as anything to dissolve it, nothing works really well. There are a couple of medications out there that have been used for that. And the other problem with the gallbladder is sometimes it just doesn't contract down to pump that bile out. And the longer it sits there, it loses some of its moisture content, and those bile salts can form a gallstone. And if it's big enough that it can't get through that little passageway through the duct into the small intestine, that's when you got problems and it needs to be taken out. But yeah, Sue, it'd be great if you had that. Now, kidney stones, a little bit similar process. So basically, if you get dehydrated frequently, if you work outside, if you're in the South in the summertime for long periods of time, or if you excrete certain calcium compounds in your urine more than other people, all those things can be really causes. And kidney stones can be from a number of different things. So I mentioned calcium. Calcium oxalate is probably the most common one, but you can have other types of kidney stones. Gout is another cause of that. So when you have uric acid stones. But yeah, there's not really anything that you can use to dissolve those once they get in there. Number one, we can't get to that area very well. It's not like you can take a pill. It still would have to go through the body and be excreted exclusively in the urine. It probably causes a lot of more problems than it's worth. But it would be nice to have if we could get to that area where those stones are and sort of dissolve them. Of course, there's other things that people use to do that. Ultrasound is another one, particularly for the kidney stone issue, but it can be a problem. So, yeah, no good solutions there, Sue, but that's certainly sometimes surgery is the only route.
I don't know if you remember back in the day when if you had your gallbladder out, they had to cut you from, the surgeon had to cut you from your navel all the way to your spine.
Yeah.
To get in there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a long.
That's why I never had it taken out.
Yeah. Now it's just, you know, most of the time they can do those laparoscopically in your home the same day.
Oh, well, thank you, Doc.
All right. Thank you, Sue. We're going to go to Diane, who's on the road. Good morning, Diane. Oh, Diane.
Hey. Yeah, are you there?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello?
Uh-huh.
So about 20 years ago, I was in my early 20s, and I was diagnosed with an overactive thyroid, hyperactive thyroid. And I remember, and I took medication for about a year, and then it just basically popped back into place, and I haven't had to take thyroid medication since. But I remember my doctor saying something, and he's long since passed away, but I remember him saying something about the timing of the blood draw is a huge deal with thyroid, and he had me come in like 4 or 5 days in a row to do blood draws because the first one and the second one, they weren't showing any level, you know, weird TSH levels, but then like the third and fourth one did. And I remember him telling me that he could tell when his wife's thyroid was out of whack because it was when he could actually test her, because her body heat went up. But he could just tell by, like, just touching her that she was just putting off more body heat. Is that something that's known? Is that one day your thyroid can test fine and then the next day not?
Yeah, you can have variability in that. And I will say the testing for that has gotten a lot better over time so that we don't have to worry as much. It's not like a fasting level or different times of day. It's pretty specific on that. However, it does change. And there's lots of different things that happen to people that can change their thyroid levels. Pregnancy is a good example of that. Illness. You know, you may have heard the term euthyroid sick. It means your thyroid's working just fine. If you have an illness or you have a hospitalization and then you test thyroid hormones during that hospitalization, even without any symptoms, and they're going to be abnormal a lot of the time. So we know that that changes. It's probably a good thing. You don't necessarily need to replace the levels of thyroid hormone during those changes. But yeah, there are a lot of changes. Then that's why just repeating the test may be the best thing. Same kind of thing if you had a hyper or an overactive or hyperthyroidism, that can resolve over time too. So a lot of times a doctor will just watch that for a while. We won't have to do any medications or surgery to follow up.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yes. Thank you for calling. We're going to try to squeeze in Mikey from Mobile in the last couple of minutes that we have. Good morning, Mikey.
Sleep deprivation, Doc.
Does that mean you are going through sleep deprivation?
Yes, sir. And I think that it means everybody is going through sleep deprivation. Now, my particular case is that overnight with the storms coming on, I have these two dogs. One is 8 pounds, the size of a newborn baby, I might point out, and as cute as a teddy bear or cuter. And the other one is 3 years older. Anyway, middle of night, get up, Mikey, I gotta go out, and then I want to play because it's nice and warm and there's a storm coming in. Yeah. So it's not necessarily just, but there are people who do have newborn babies. I'm sure you've never talked to any of those, right?
Oh no. Or experienced that. You're right. Yeah. It's very common and at different points, but, I think you're leaning towards the effects of this, right? Yeah.
So what do you achieve? I've got a sleep tea and I got coffee to wake me back up. The problem is that I'm still like,
dragging,
nodding off. Please forgive me, Doc, but I nodded off for a few minutes during this program when I did not want to.
Some people say your voice is so soothing there. So I got about 30 seconds to answer your question. Let me put a couple of things in there for you that might help. So you mentioned a couple of things. People, getting back in that sleep cycle, if you can, of course, remove the things that are interrupting your sleep, trying to make sure that you have good sleep hygiene, making sure the room's dark, those kinds of things, if you can. Melatonin can help to sort of recharge that cycle. So taking that right after something that happens can be useful. It doesn't work as well long term. And then a lot of people try the sleep teas or honey. Those are great. And just making sure that you have a restful environment, that can be beneficial. So all of those things, I think, can be ways that you can affect that. This is Southern Remedy, and it's been a production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting Think Radio and is funded in part by a grant from the University of Mississippi Medical Center. I'm Dr. Jimmy Stewart, Professor of Internal Medicine and Pediatrics at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. Southern Remedy is produced by Kevin Farrell, and the podcast producer is Jermaine Flood. You can tune to MPB Think Radio every weekday morning at 11 for the full Southern Remedy lineup.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. To hear previous shows, visit mpbonline.org or download the MPB Public Radio app to listen on your iPhone or Android phone on demand.